This is America Unfiltered, a fresh, raw look at American politics, foreign policy, and media, with me, Liam Kennedy, in Dublin.
And me, Scott Lucas, in Birmingham, England.
Scott, we've made it to episode 7 of America Unfiltered, and this is the last episode of the first season. It's been quite a ride. This is an interesting time to be talking about the United States. So here we are, and things are not really calming down much. Although I must say, it looks like President Trump is trying to just be a bit more presidential in the last week. I use that word deliberately because when he was running for president, he told a crowd, "You wait and see, I'm going to be so presidential." And I'm still not sure what he meant about that, but I know that a lot of folks invested in the idea that when he became president, somehow this august post would shape him into what a president is supposed to be. And people are still hoping that's going to happen. He gave a couple of speeches this week in which he was just a little bit calmer than usual, still rambling, but a little bit calmer. And the media in the United States are saying, "Oh, look at the change in tone. He's becoming more presidential." What do you think?
Yeah, right. I mean, you can't take the boy out of the chaos, and you can't take the chaos out of the boy. And in fact, I mean, that line for me, which goes beyond Trump, which in an America with coronavirus, with the issues raised by Black Lives Matter, with an economy in trouble, is this one of chaos versus competence. So actually, let me start on the other side. First of all, I mean, the most important speech for me this week was actually by Donald Trump's opponent for the presidency in November, Joe Biden. Biden continues to present a very detailed plan. $2 trillion plan for environmental protection and economic recovery. And in the latest speech, which he gave in Delaware yesterday, he talked about, well, this division has to end. We've got to find some way to bring the country together. But quite frankly, Donald Trump's only pouring fuel on the fire. In other words, this chaos with Trump is deliberate. It's not just inherent. He's actually trying to stoke things. So just to remind the listeners of what has occurred in the 24 hours before you and I recorded this, he comes out on Twitter and he launches a series of retweets which just trash the leading White House coronavirus expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, which accused Fauci of actually having manufactured this crisis, of trying to undermine the president. His son, Donald Trump Jr., is reprimanded by Twitter for putting out a video by a conspiracy theorist doctor who believes that vaccines are being created by aliens working with doctors to, subject us to their control. And all of this is at a time when the United States is going to pass the 150,000 dead mark and is closing on 4.5 million cases. And those rates of death are increasing. They're at their highest level since mid-May. So here Trump appears at the White House briefing, and there's no Fauci, there's no Elizabeth Birx, the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. It's just Trump going off on a ramble, which is, why does everybody like Dr. Anthony Fauci? Why don't they like me? So all those deaths, all that acting presidential comes down to his ego. And then on top of that, he goes on to a spree about, of course, the anarchist and the extremist. But here's where it gets interesting for me, Liam. It's not just Trump that did this yesterday. It's his political appointee, Attorney General William Barr, who is dragged reluctantly to a House hearing, doesn't want to be there, but just evades questions about coronavirus, evades questions about foreign interference in elections, and just simply continues to double down on the idea that the Trump administration had to deploy paramilitary troops, Homeland Security troops, to detain and even beat protesters. Of course, he didn't call it that. He said, law and order, but detain and beat protesters. Because if you can't win this election that's coming up on competence, if you can't win it on dealing with coronavirus, if you can't win it on an economy which will recover by November, what do you do it? You turn this into an all-out culture war of us versus them. And that's where Trump and his inner circle are now, at least their narrative, for the next 98 days until November 3rd.
This is ratcheting up the fear. There's no question about it. You mentioned culture wars. A lot of echoes there of things we've heard and seen before, at least those of us are aged enough. And I'm thinking back to the late 1960s. And it seems that Donald Trump may be thinking back to that as well. There has been references to 1968 in particular, as we now see what's happening in Baltimore. And of course, President Nixon, or would become President Nixon, made a lot about, you know, law and order in relationship to the protests that were happening in the streets of the bigger cities and Democratic-led cities, again, in the United States at that time. So we fast forward to the present day. Do you think that Trump is trying to take something out of the Nixon playbook? And do you think it can work for him? To which I add, at the moment, the polls don't seem to think so. We're seeing that a perhaps surprising number of white voters are disapproving of Trump's handling of the protests. But there's a struggle here over the meaning of what's going on in America. And that struggle is going to be so important in the coming months, isn't it?
First of all, is he trying to replay the Nixon playbook from 1968 when he tweets in all caps, not only law and order, but, you know, the silent majority? Where do you think that phrase came from? But here's the kicker. Richard Nixon wasn't president in 68 when we were dealing with marches, when we were dealing with questions of justice, when we were dealing with questions of rights. He was the one that was attacking the Democrats who held the White House. So, Liam, who was the last Republican president in an election year when we had unrest? Do you remember who that was?
Depends what you mean by unrest. Are you thinking of the opposition to the U.S. going into Iraq?
Well, no, in terms of domestic unrest, I'm actually thinking in 1992, when we had unrest in Los Angeles after the beating of Rodney King.
Oh, of course. Yes, yes.
And George H.W. Bush was president then, and we know who won that election in November.
Yes.
It wasn't the Republican incumbent.
That's right. That's right.
Fast forward almost 30 years in something which has become bigger than Los Angeles, which has become nationwide. And I think that shows that combined with coronavirus, combined with just general questions about his stability, let alone his competence, this is very much an uphill battle for Donald Trump. Never say never, but it's an uphill battle for Trump going into November.
Yeah, these elections, what could possibly go wrong? And by that, I don't mean, will Trump get elected or not get elected? You can go right or wrong based on your politics on that one. That's fair enough. What I mean is, you know, will the election take place? And in what format will it take place? The pandemic conditions are such that we really don't know what policies will be in place in which states in terms of the numbers of people who can turn up and can get access to vote. There's a huge number of issues here. The technology of some of the new polling systems is questionable, to say the least. And then we have the small matter of, let's say, President Trump narrowly getting defeated on the numbers. Will he actually leave? What do you think?
Well, when he was asked that question just over a week ago by Chris Wallace of Fox News, in typical Trumpian style, he said, oh, I won't say yes, I won't say no, you know, I'll keep you guessing. He's not ruling out staying in office, even if the election goes against him. In other words, if you can't win on the economy, you can't win over the handling of coronavirus, burn it all down. If you can't get Black Lives Matter to burn it all down, you burn it down yourself. And by that, I mean Donald Trump will spread the seed with the falsehood repeatedly that postal voting is fraudulent. Now, why is he doing that? Because if the pandemic continues, mail-in voting is going to become incredibly important for those who don't want to go into what could be crowded polling stations. So you say mail-in voting is fraudulent. You say that the entire system is rigged. And he's already saying that, as he did in 2016 in advance of the election. So you set up that idea, which is, if I can't get the elections delayed, because only Congress has the power to do that, then if this election goes against me, I'm not going to acknowledge the result. And we're not talking like 2000 in Florida, where it was so close, and where because the election was so badly run in Bush versus Gore over Florida that you had to have the Supreme Court deliberate for weeks, just Trump defying the entire system. I think he can do that, Liam, if it is a narrow loss. But if, and the current polls show this, if he winds up losing all those key states he won in 2016, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and he also possibly even loses some diehard Republican states like Arizona and Georgia, then I think even Trump, if the gap is large, it becomes difficult for him to try to pull this off.
Yeah, I mean, the polls are pointing that way, and but we have to be careful. If we're not on this podcast for a month and come back, those polls could look very different. We know that. But you're absolutely right. Just looking at the polls as you speak, I've been told that Biden has an average 8.7% lead nationwide. If you take the poll of polls, that's a large lead at the minute. And some of the swing states, it's very big. He's got 11 points ahead in Pennsylvania. People mightn't have thought that was even possible. But also, if you go down ballot and look at those polls as well, you're sort of starting to look into the weeds a little bit, I suppose, but you can see the possibility of even, some are saying as many as 5, 6, even 7 Senate seats going to the Democrats. That may not sound a lot, but in fact, if all of this happens, you could be looking at some kind of, what do they call it, a tidal wave. But nonetheless, all of these are, you know, hopeful straws in the wind in some degree. Let's talk a little bit about Joe Biden, okay? He seems to have been doing okay by not doing very much. What happens when he comes out into the public? What happens when people get a chance to look at him more carefully? What happens when the media get a little tired about saying this and that about Donald Trump and start to push harder at Joe Biden, his policies, whether he can stand up to at least 4 years, if not more, of the presidency? Do you think Biden can get over the line?
Hey, don't buy into that Trump myth that he's still in the basement. Joe Biden's already out there. I mean, since, you know, he was even before, even during the height of coronavirus back in March and in April, the first wave, he was speaking to the media. He was, you know, doing video casts from his home. But then he came out in public on May 31st, Memorial Day ceremony. And over the course of the past 2 months, as we've entered the resurgence of coronavirus, he has made a series of key speeches while being socially distanced. So he has presented that economic platform. You know, build America better. He has presented that plan to link it to fighting climate change. He has brought out a series of measures in terms of dealing with the issues raised by Black Lives Matter. He's moved closer towards Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, the Trump folks will say, oh, this means he's an extremist. He's been captured by the radicals. So far, it's not sticking. In other words, those opinion polls with Biden opening up his lead is not in the absence of Biden. He has been present there, even if he doesn't grab the Twitter headlines like Donald Trump does. Because I think going beyond Trump versus Biden, Liam, and going beyond just what America sees of itself, this is the most important election since 1945 in terms of where America goes and where you have competing narratives. And one narrative of that, which Americans tell themselves, but which they present to the world, is the Trumpian narrative now. And that is, you can't trust anybody. There are enemies all around us, whether it's the Chinese, the World Health Organization, Dr. Fauci, whether it's extremist, whether it's any country in the world except for Russia. So you have that Trumpian narrative, which really is the one of disorder, of chaos, of uncertainty, but you have to keep him there as the supposedly the bulwark against this. And then the other narrative is that which is not only from Biden, but from Democratic congressional candidates, and I think from activists, including those of Black Lives Matter, which is you need leadership, you need responsibility, and you need competence by all of us. In other words, not to divide, but a collective effort. We'll see which one of those plays out in the first week of November if we have an election which is not sidelined by Trump. And the outcome of that election, of course, is important not only in terms of who takes the White House, but which American narrative then is presented to the world for the next 4 years.
That's absolutely right. For better or worse, the world looks to America for leadership. I know that that light has dimmed over the last 4 years. But I think it's also true that people around the world tend to see America through the lens or the prism of its president. Again, for better or worse, that has been the case for a very long time. So this is a very important election. It will set the tone for so much, not just domestically, but also globally. And of course, here at America Unfiltered, that has been our focus, really. It's looking at America's place in the world. It's looking at what's going on in the United States, but we're asking questions always about its impact. So it's fitting that for the last podcast of our season, I caught up with Professor Kevin Gaines, who's the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice at the University of Virginia. And we talked a bit about the American Civil Rights Movement, but we talked about it in terms of its international dimensions so that we could really get a better understanding, not just of what's going on in the streets, but how that is infused by an international movement for civil rights. And that's going to have a bearing on how the United States is viewed around the world and whether or not it can continue to have leadership around the world. Could you take us back to the mid-20th century, to the civil rights movement, which is coming into full bloom at that time, and tell us a bit about how it's not just a domestic movement, but also an international one.
It's really important to think of the movement as a global phenomenon and part of a particular and complicated global moment. You can think of it as the post-World War II political era being defined by the relationship between these three central historical processes, and the U.S. civil rights movement is one. The Cold War struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union is the second. And the third is decolonization, which was the emergence of new independent African and Asian nations from European colonial rule. So all of those historical processes interacted and unfolded in real time. You know, historians of the U.S. civil rights movement point to key events like the Brown decision, the Supreme Court decision that declared segregation in public education and public schools unconstitutional. And they also point to the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 and 1956, which resulted in the successful desegregation of public transportation in Montgomery and in the state of Alabama. But those events are happening within a global order of the Cold War. You had, at the same time, nonviolent protests in South Africa against apartheid that are happening in real time, you know, almost simultaneous to the Montgomery bus boycott. And participants in each of these movements in South Africa and in the United States are aware of these movements and aware of this confluence of global Black struggles against racial oppression. So, and then, of course, the Cold War is very significant because if you look at the Supreme Court's majority opinion for the Brown decision, you know, there is quite a bit of acknowledgement of the need for the United States to end segregation in public schools because desegregation was a Cold War imperative. It was necessary for the United States to be credible in its claims that the United States was the leader of the free world against, you know, Soviet totalitarianism. So it's very important to think of the connection between the U.S. civil rights movement and these international developments, like such as the Cold War and decolonization of Africa and Asia.
Looking back to that moment, Kevin, before we come forward, and because you've sketched out the connectivity, I was just curious. You said that, you know, folks in Africa who are protesting would be aware of those in the United States. So how did the connectivity work? I mean, they didn't have social media. How were they connecting with each other? Was it musical? Was it popular culture? Was it people traveling? Was it all of the above?
I think there are, you know, certainly quite a few connections. Right now, we have, as a result of the Cold War, journalism and photojournalism are circulating internationally. One of the reasons why the civil rights movement has to be seen in a global context is because of the world press. Images of some of the atrocities in the civil rights movement, the violent resistance to civil rights in Birmingham, for example, by police, or the images of the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, these went around the world through photojournalism and were, you know, picked up by the world press. So that's one, you know, just the international circulation of news and visual imagery about the movement. The United States, actually, their official efforts, U.S. official efforts at managing the image of the United States abroad as part of its Cold War struggle for hegemony over the Soviet Union, that projected the civil rights movement and its aims and allies internationally. The United States was trying to manage the image of America abroad while it was a Jim Crow nation and still very much subject to internal unrest. You had all of these desegregation crises in the 1950s, the Little Rock crisis, And then going into the 1960s, the violence attendant, the desegregation of University of Mississippi, when James Meredith became the first Black man to attend the University of Mississippi. You had the violence of the Freedom Rides, in which interracial protesters trying to desegregate public transportation facilities in the South were beaten and by, you know, police and vigilante elements. So the United States is trying to manage the image of America at a time when a very unstable and uncertain time when the white South is unified in resisting desegregation, resisting civil rights, and willing to use violence for it. So the U.S. actually projects in their efforts to try to win hearts and minds abroad, and they're trying to win hearts and minds with many non-white peoples who are coming out of colonial rule as part of this process of decolonization. So that is one, I guess you could say, vector of imagery of the struggle. Then you have an independent sort of Black radical Pan-African project in which the independence of the West African nation of Ghana really highlights the a more independent and Black radical perspective on civil rights. And so Kwame Nkrumah was well known to Black Americans as the first prime minister of independent Ghana. Ghana got its independence from Britain in 1957. Nkrumah was a world statesman, and he invited the leaders of the U.S. civil rights movement to the independence festivities in Ghana. And so you had Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and Ralph Bunche and others attending Ghana's independence festivities. And this is a really heady moment. The independence of Ghana occurred at a time in 1957 when the civil rights movement in the United States had pretty much stalled. Dr. King had a huge success with the Montgomery bus boycott, but the Eisenhower administration was really foot-dragging on the issue of civil rights and wouldn't accept a high-level meeting with Dr. King. So Ghana's independence provided a platform for the global aspirations of African Americans for civil rights in the United States, but also Africans for liberation from colonialism on the African continent. And Nkrumah said that the independence of Ghana is meaningless without the total liberation of the African continent. So you think of these two kind of rival circuits, international circuits of the Black struggle. You have the United States sending out through its information agencies film footage of the March on Washington to overseas audiences, but you also have people like Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana really embodying a much more independent and radical vision of Pan-African liberation and you know, explicitly linking African-American struggles for civil rights with African liberation struggles on the continent.
And you mentioned media earlier. That sort of intersecting of circuits also has a sort of cultural dialectic as well, doesn't it? We see aspects of African-American culture taken up in states in Africa and in Europe at that time, but also we see that replaying back into the United States, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, culture was a major terrain of this Cold War struggle. And you could sort of look at culture both within a domestic frame. There's this explosion of popular music and literature in response to, in relation to the U.S. civil rights movement. I mean, this is the period in which we see the emergence of figures, popular musicians like Bob Dylan, Stevie Wonder, Nina Simone, Motown and Marvin Gaye, Aretha Franklin, Curtis Mayfield. You know, you can't really appreciate their musical success and their sort of global popularity without understanding their rootedness in the U.S. civil rights struggle. And, you know, there's a Pan-African dimension to it as well. There are segments of the African-American activist community that are certainly supportive of civil rights, but they're also very much committed to supporting decolonization in Africa. And in 1960, there was an international crisis around the independence of the Congo. And you had what became known as the Congo Crisis. The Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo gained its independence from Belgian colonial rule in 1960. Immediately, Belgian military, political officials, in tandem with the powerful economic mining interests in the country, instigated a civil war and destabilized the country. And so African Americans were very aware of this phenomenon, particularly African Americans in New York, who and in Harlem, who are, you know, just a subway ride away from the United Nations and are engaging with, you know, socializing with, in contact with African diplomats. So the Congo Crisis was a major turning point in the decolonization of Africa. You know, in the United States, sort of liberal, sort of Cold War opinion leaders in the press, you know, were constantly sort of preoccupied with this question of whether or not political change, both in the United States and in Africa, could occur nonviolently, could occur peacefully. Well, the Congo Crisis ended with the assassination of the democratically elected prime minister of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, by you know, Belgian forces. And, you know, they put out, the official story that Belgium put out when they announced his death was that he had been killed by rival tribesmen. And African Americans, who were really connected with African independence issues, smelled a rat and staged a protest at the United Nations that got a lot of publicity. And Lumumba was basically hailed by these African American, I guess you could call them internationalists, who were really supportive of Africa. They saw Lumumba as a martyr, and their position was taken up by Malcolm X, who was probably the most prominent exponent of this Pan-African sensibility that united the African-American struggles for freedom with African liberation struggles.
The connectivity through to the present is very powerful in all of these registers. I was also thinking and listening to that certain individuals connect the period you're talking about right through to the present with a Pan-African sensibility. And one of those, I think I'm right in saying, would be John Lewis, who sadly passed away recently. I mean, he visited Africa in, was it 64, 65? I'm not sure. You will know better than I. And right through to his later days, he spoke out about a range of human rights issues in African countries. And I remember he talked about Somalia in those terms. He also talked about Haiti in those terms. He seems to be an individual who is very much part of that international sensibility you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Lewis was the director of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he has said and written that SNCC's commitment to voting rights, the voting rights issue, and their organizing in Mississippi was really, to a great extent, informed by Pan-African demands for freedom. And, you know, one of the slogans of SNCC in their voting rights organizing and campaigning was one man, one vote, or one person, one vote. And they had gotten that from the anti-apartheid struggle. So there's this tremendous awareness, and SNCC certainly exhibited that kind of international consciousness of seeing the struggle of African Americans in the Deep South for basic, you know, civil and voting rights, as connected with struggles of African peoples for freedom.
If we take you forward now, since we've mentioned John Lewis as well, and we take you forward to the present day, clearly it is quite a leap. But do you see certain similarities in terms of, you began talking about this earlier moment as a conjunctural moment where we have, you know, very significant movements and changes that are happening at the same time. Do you think we're at another conjuncture today in terms of the deep significance of the protest to push forward for racial justice in the United States and beyond?
I think so. It's hard not to see these kinds of global connections with the global protests in response to the killing of George Floyd and recent police and vigilante killings of African Americans, and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement as a response to police and vigilante violence against Black men and women. I think that in a lot of ways, the foundation for this current moment was laid by the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, because the Black Power movement in the late 1960s and 1970s really inspired Black protest movements throughout Europe and the Caribbean and to some extent in Latin America. And so you had these really iconic figures of the Black struggle traveling internationally. And, you know, in Britain, the Black Power era and led to what you could call a truly autonomous and powerful Black protest movement against police and vigilante anti-Black violence during the 1960s and 1970s through the 1980s. So I think those are foundations, you know, for when you look at the massive demonstrations in London. You know, you have to sort of acknowledge that there's this longstanding concern, you know, within the Black community in Britain of around issues of police brutality. And so, you know, this recent explosion of protests in the United States in response to George Floyd's death really kind of reactivated that tradition.
Just thinking a little bit more of some of the differences as well as the similarities between that earlier moment of the 60s and 70s and today, I wonder about leadership a little bit. And I know this is something you've written about in the past, because, of course, when we talk and look backwards, rightly or wrongly, we think of great leaders when we think of that civil rights movement of the mid-20th century. Today, one of the, I think, really intriguing features of Black Lives Matter and its related movements is it's so decentralized. It deliberately avoids having these singular leaders. How do you read that politically? And is that an astute way to move forward strategically, or is something being missed there?
Well, in some ways, the decentralized nature of Black Lives Matter and their reliance on local organizers and leaders does reflect certain aspects of the 1960s civil rights movement. You know, you did have a whole group, a quite substantial group of local leaders whose names are not as well known as, you know, Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, but whose work was and organizing was vital to the movement. And, you know, you do have, you know, quite a few folks who in some ways laid the foundation for the modern civil rights movement, but they're unsung figures, people who've gotten some recognition by scholars more recently. And I think with the Black Lives Matter movement, they do have a sense of the history of the civil rights movement, that, you know, the Black Lives Matter approach to leadership of being sort of decentralized is really, I think, an attempt to, it's a rejection of the model of charismatic leadership that was really sort of dominant during the U.S. civil rights movement.
One further, perhaps final point of connectivity between the movements, the moments of the movements, is to think about the efforts to control the narrative, if you like. It's such an important thing, and we see that today it's a challenge. We're seeing remarkable support across the United States and across the world for what's going on with those protests. But there is a challenge there to keep some control of that narrative going forward. In part, that I suppose is a claim to a moral narrative in terms of how one is going to understand these events. How do you read that? Do you think this is sustainable? What do you, you can't read the future, but in terms of your understanding of what you've read before and what you understand about these movements historically and internationally, how do you read the current moment in terms of the narrative of the movement?
This is really the challenge that the movement faces, and we are at a crucial turning point with the Black Lives Matter protests in the United States, in which the state, the U.S. government, the Trump administration, and the Justice Department are portraying these protesters who are, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, peaceful and nonviolent as violent, as, you know, anti-American. It's really sort of reminiscent of the worst kind of red baiting and you know, sort of demonization of the movement. And I guess the key issue is whether or not the American people, American citizens, will resist that. With what's going on in Portland so far, it seems that people are resisting what looks like a clear authoritarian power grab. And we shall see. I think that, you know, democracy, the fight for democracy now in the United States is going to continue to be in the streets. And let's hope that it remains nonviolent and that the force of numbers and people who are committed to defending democracy will prevail.
That was America Unfiltered. This episode wraps up season one. Check back in with us in a few weeks' time when we will have information on the new season focused on the US election. Let's also check out our ongoing coverage of American politics, foreign policy, and media on AU's website and also on our partner EA Worldview's website. Goodbye from Dublin.